is correct.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Moments of Truth, the show about my favorite moments from my favorite things. I'm Bill Coffin, and today we'll be discussing the adult animated action comedy series, The Venture Brothers. Premiering on Adult Swim in 2004, The Venture Brothers is an episodic satire of the 1960s animated series Johnny Quest, as well as James Bond movies, Hanna-Barbera cartoons, superhero comics, and just about every other kind of space-age boy adventure franchise imaginable. It asks the question, what kind of adult would a kid trapped in a boy adventure scenario grow up to be? Turns out, not a healthy one. The show follows the extraordinary adventures of Dr. Thaddeus Rusty Venture, who as a boy accompanied his father, the brilliant and daring adventure scientist Jonas Venture, on his globe-trotting escapades. But after his father's untimely death, and in this universe, is there any other kind? Rusty begins a lifelong career of coasting on his dad's reputation, defending his own mediocrity as a super scientist, and running what remains of Venture Industries. Dr. Venture is joined by his hapless and dim-witted fraternal twin sons, Dean and Hank, and they are all protected by the hulking and sometimes maniacal secret agent Brock Sampson, who takes advantage of his license to kill at every possible opportunity. Team Venture is surrounded by an expansive cast of characters, including their butterfly-themed nemesis, the Monarch, and his femme fatale partner, Dr. Girlfriend, the necromantic ally Dr. Orpheus and his daughter Triana, the dutiful robot helper, Baron Werner Unterweit. I can't even say it. This guy killed it. Baron Werner Unterweit. Pete White and Master Billy Quizboy, Phantom Limb, Henchman 21, and many others. Hilarious, sharply written, briskly paced, and impossibly dense with pop culture references, The Venture Brothers ran for 7 seasons, spanning 81 episodes, until it was finally canceled in 2020. A direct-to-video movie, Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart, what a title that is, premieres digitally on July 21st, 2023 on, I believe, Cartoon Network and Max, which will then bring the story of the Venture Brothers finally to a close. The show was never a massive commercial hit for Adult Swim, but it was a critical darling with a passionate and devoted fan base who appreciated the series' willingness to lampoon its inspirational material with unprecedented brilliance. No character goes undeveloped, no matter how small. No detail goes unnoticed, no matter how trivial. Jokes are set up and then left to sit for entire seasons before their punchline. It has been rated as one of the best adult animated series ever and has helped to pave the way for great shows like BoJack Horseman, Archer, and of course, Rick and Morty. The show mines geek territory in ways that now seems kind of obvious and surface level, but this thing got going 4 years before Iron Man ever came out. So it was letting a geek flag fly without the safety net of knowing if there was a mainstream culture waiting for it. More than anything, The Venture Brothers is just weird, and it knows it is, and it never apologizes for it. You can either join in or watch it go by, but this show is not going to beg you to love it by diluting what it is just so it can make itself more saleable or accessible. While it doesn't exactly gatekeep, the show's Gen X pop culture deep cuts and self-referential callbacks can make it a challenging watch for those who don't start at the beginning. But for those who do, what awaits is one of the richest and smartest comedies around. So let's get into it. With me today is Movie Night Survivor, Chris Crenshaw.
Sharky's Machine.
Marketing Director for the Guild of Calamitous Intent, Tom Hespos.
Bait You Can Trust is the new Be All You Can Be.
And Ghost Rider of The Flight of the Monarch, Chris Swan.
It's powered by a forsaken child.
Everybody, welcome. I've been looking forward to this episode so very much. This episode has been one of our so-called golden ticket episodes for the season, where each of us had one particular topic that we really wanted to do, and it was an opportunity, if some of the others weren't already familiar with it, to get familiar with it. So this was Chris's golden ticket episode. He chose The Venture Brothers, and I will say I had never seen the show before we started prepping for this episode. And Chris, I'm very deeply grateful that you brought this up and you shared this show with me and got me to check it out. One of the things we often say about this show is that not only are we celebrating things we already love, but we really enjoy when the things we talk about are a vector for us to learn something new or for us to experience something we haven't gotten into just yet. On that vein, I am really, really excited about this episode because it's been a blast getting to know The Venture Brothers a whole lot. I will say you had recommended to us, you know, if you can't watch the entire show, at the very least, watch the entire first season and the first episode of the second season. So that's what I've done for the show. So my knowledge of Venture Brothers only goes that far. And I'll be speaking to all the people out there who know Venture Brothers and are going to love it, you know, in that little realm, but also people maybe who haven't seen it yet. And like, you know what? I haven't gotten around to it. Well, this is your invitation to get around to it. All that said, Chris, start us off with, you know, sharing with us your moment of truth in the show. You're the resident expert on the show. So walk us into what this moment is, its context in the show, why you love it, and then I'll ask you a few more questions to kind of help set the stage here.
Bill, I'm really excited to do this episode too, obviously. Everybody thought I was going to do Moon Knight for my golden ticket, but everybody, you know, was going to watch Moon Knight on the Disney show. So I realized I had a chance to really share something I loved. And Venture Brothers is one of my favorite franchises of all time. I love this show so, so much. And it's a real delight that to me that you guys have enjoyed it. And we're gonna only be talking really about the first season and the first episode of the second season in this show. So, you know, it's reasonably self-contained. Autumn 2004, my marriage wasn't great. Sally would walk out on me for the first time that winter. So I was probably escaping to the living room during like one of those nights where Lost and The Bachelor came on back to back.
Right.
I sat down on the bed.
Dark times.
Yeah. I sat down on the bed.
There's a message in there somewhere. Wait a minute.
And I turned on an Adult Swim. I was a late adopter on Adult Swim. I liked Space Ghost Coast to Coast, but I had never watched any of the, you know, like Aqua Teen Hunger Force or anything else, really.
Aqua Teen.
Before. That autumn, Cartoon Network bought the rights to Family Guy and Futurama, committing to making new episodes of both.
Right.
And so that brought me to Adult Swim. And I might have seen a promo of Venture Brother, maybe, but this one night I'm just sitting in there looking for something to watch, and there it is. The first one I saw, I'm pretty positive, was episode 108, the eighth episode filmed, but the sixth one aired. It's called Ghosts of the Sargasso. And I'm pretty sure I caught it as a rerun because the weather was cool. I remember the weather being cool, but it originally aired on September 11th of that year. But from the very opening, which quotes from and reenacts the events of David Bowie's Space Oddity, in, as Bill said, like you can't believe they're doing it in one of those sequences, like, and they do it, they do it, yeah. All.
They do it all in.
As dialogue.
They go all in.
Yeah, I thought they're gonna stop after two lines. Like, they're gonna do the whole right. Part of the song. She knows. Yeah.
but from the really from the beginning, I realized that the show was riffing on Johnny Quest. I recognized Jonas Venture as Johnny's dad, and yeah. and like the action team that, you know, people you sometimes saw around the Venture family, because the Quest family. Look, yeah. I get confused. Yeah. I was a Johnny Quest boy.
Same.
Growing up.
Same. I love Johnny Quest.
You know, that show came out like, I think it, like 6 or 7 years before we were born. Yeah. But it was, you know, in common rotation on Saturday mornings. And
yeah.
I loved it. And so it just immediately spoke to me. The story of this episode, it could easily have been a Johnny Quest adventure gone wrong, or an episode of Scooby-Doo.
And
I think that's what drew me in. It has this self-aware, sardonic take on what life would have been like for a character like Johnny Quest, which is not good. I should point out that eventually you're going to find that Johnny Quest actually is a character in this show in the form of Action Johnny.
Yeah.
For that matter, so is David Bowie. These are not spoilers, they're teasers.
It is teasers. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is the beauty of this show, because that right there, like just David Bowie showing up, like that's right. The whole meaning. They're like, no, that's just like a side.
Yeah, they just chuck it in.
But you're right, Bill. They just chuck it in. And then they go on to make it a major plot thing. in season like 6 and 7, things change, man. Things change.
I can't wait to get to it. I really
can't.
This is
what's great about this show. In this universe, magic is just as real as super science, and it's just as disappointing. Like, pretty much every single adult character you're going to meet in this episode goes to the Sargasso. And in fact, really, throughout season one, is going to come back. And every one of them is at some level or on many levels a failure.
Yeah.
Rusty was never as smart as his dad. You know, and even the military's long since lost interest, right?
Yeah.
The age of super science is over, and magic is, you know, as it turns out, basically futile. So in many ways, it's a show about our disappointments.
Yeah.
The makers will tell you that failure is the central theme of Venture Brothers. They say it over and over again. The other theme is family. And that's where all the heart of this show comes from.
Yeah.
You know, which might surprise you, because in the first season, you know, we see what kind of dad Rusty is. When he needs a kidney transplant, he takes one from each of his sons, leaving them both worse off than him.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Like, yeah. That's not a good dad. No, right?
That's like the first episode.
But
table stakes.
Right.
Spoiler alert. Yeah, right. Spoiler, he's a horrible dad. Yeah, right? Oh my god.
But it's also a clue to what's coming.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. and what the stakes really are. Yeah. And despite Rusty's absolute shittiness, you're gonna find that his friends and family stick by him time after time. They bail him out over and over again. Among the ones who survive, every one of these new characters in Ghost of the Sargasso is going to be seen again. The sea captain becomes like a regular on the show, like a real, like almost Brock level character.
What? The pirate captain?
Yes.
Ah!
Like, nice.
He was so good. He was so good as a Scooby-Doo villain, suddenly caught in like real life consequences.
Right.
Wait a minute. This is just like, run away from your ship and give us your stuff. What the hell?
You had to kill that guy?
I'm so unprepared for Brock Samson's level of violence.
Brock just shrugs.
He just shrugs. Yeah, I suppose.
Brock Samson, by the way, we haven't said, is played impeccably by Patrick Warburton.
Chef's kiss, you know, every single episode. Oh, yeah. So good.
First episode, he opens his mouth. I heard that voice. I was like, of course. There's no one.
Yeah.
Who else could it be?
He's someone completely unknown, or you're going to get Warburton. It's perfect.
It's perfect. And but you know, the way these characters, they just hold on to them. The writers do not let anything go to waste. They never let anything go to waste. And so everybody comes back, and every plot point comes back. I picked my intro tonight, the movie Night Survivor. They teased that in the episode in the first season, Careers in Science. And later in the series, you find out what happened on movie night. And then later after that, you find out what really happened on movie night. And after that, you find out what really, really happened on movie night.
And I just love that they're going to refer back to Sharky's Machine of all things.
Yes,
like
they
four
will.
They're
going to use the music.
But they pull out things that don't deserve references and make them references.
Those are
our
fight
attention.
Wars.
Like,
Burt Reynolds always deserves a reference. And as an Archer fan, you should know that.
Okay, that's true, but not for Sharky's Machine, man. Maybe Malone, maybe Stick, but come on, Sharky's Machine, please. You're killing me.
Yeah, I saw it.
I love that about it, though. Like, you sit there and like you're
Sharky's
plotting,
Machine.
You know, when you're our age, you're plotting through a world where nobody understands your references anyway.
Yeah,
and then, like, to be exposed to a show where you actually have to use your brain a bit and like think about some of these references, like Sharky's Machine. Holy crap! Like, I would have never put that in the recall bin had that show like ever, yeah. You know, had yeah. that show not said anything.
So. It's an animated love letter to Gen X.
It is. It absolutely is.
If this podcast is kind of that way.
Yeah.
That show is that show is completely
and thereby, you know, it's an ode to white privilege. I mean, this is very much very much a show aimed at dudes exactly our age and with exactly our backgrounds. So, you know, admit that all, but it's also quite sensitive. It shows a lot of awareness of social issues as it goes forward. Really does.
Yeah. I love that this was your first episode of the show that you watched, because I believe the actual first episode of Johnny Quest is they visit the Sargasso Sea, right? Yeah. So I love how
who else is going to visit the Sargasso Sea? It's like him and Jacques Cousteau.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, who else is going to go there?
Who's going to go there?
Maybe Marlon Perkins or Mutual Omaha? No.
Maybe, possibly. James Cameron.
And the credits made it clear. This is Johnny Quest.
The credit sequence is clearly. What I love is how this show does stuff like Johnny Quest better than Johnny Quest did Johnny Quest. Like, yeah. And like the opening sequence is like a banger. Like the opening, like I don't skip it when I'm watching it. It's just cool, man. I want to go jet setting around this space age and see like, you know, all kinds of stuff. But Chris, is there a particular moment in this episode that really jumps out to you? I mean, I can see why this episode has particular meaning to you, but is there a part in this episode that really jumps out as kind of the moment that really anchors this thing for you?
I picked this episode because it was the first one I saw I immediately fell in love. I'll say that I consider it a really important episode because, you know, the old Team Venture become really significant characters.
Yeah.
Colonel Gentleman in particular is probably my favorite character in the show. I love Colonel Gentleman.
With the Sean Connery accent.
Yeah. but as far as the moment in this show, I don't know. I guess it's when Brock tells the pirate, I told you what I'd do for one of those. After he has broken a man's arm with his sphincter and used him as a weapon against his friend.
It was like the most Brock Samson thing ever.
Brock Samson.
Brock Samson. The beauty of animation.
Man. Yeah. You can do freaking anything.
Yeah, right.
And this show does, man. Oh, God.
There's another episode in this season where Brock goes through a military checkpoint. He's like, don't you know who that was? Brock fucking Samson. So I can hardly.
No way. That's a cigarette butt.
Right.
He keeps doing that throughout, though. Like, there's an episode where he's like stabbing guys with a pole arm, and next thing you know, he's running around with a pole arm with like a guy
still on it,
falling around and like just like hitting guys and sending the other guy across the pile of guys, and like there's guys flying everywhere, and he's using each guy as a
motorcycle.
Hysterical.
In the pilot, there's this moment where like he's trying to come into the United Nations. His guard's like, "Sir, you can't bring a knife in here." And he goes, "Why don't you try to take it from me?" It's so unhinged. I was like, "I am so in love with this show right now." And I was like 8 minutes in, you know. So good.
The eye twitch. He's like Popeye on crack. He's like, "Yes, sure, what do you want?"
He's like Brother Lono, man. Bullets.
Oh my god, yeah. This is a little bit more topical than we typically get, but I have to say it because it just got in my head and wouldn't leave. Is in this scene, Dr. Venture gets in like one of those old like bubble armed, like old style, like 1970s diving hard suits to go down the bottom of the ocean. And of course, it's a complete shambles getting him in the water. And even as he goes down, I keep thinking, you know what? Dr. Thaddeus Venture shows more safety precautions than the freaking Ocean Gate idiot who blew himself up like a couple of weeks ago, you know, who, by the way, looked ironically like Race Bannon. I couldn't help but notice.
Right. Right? Yeah.
Like Stockton Rush looked more than a little bit like Race Bannon, which is just a little bizarre.
So, more on Race Bannon later.
More on Race Bannon later, for sure. When we were talking about this show before, and at one point I had found this video, actually Adult Swim had produced it. And I think it was in advance of season 5 coming out. And I was like, it was basically Agent 23 or Henchman number 23.
Probably 21.
21, sorry. It was Henchman 21. It's him giving an 8-minute-long recap of the first 4 seasons of Venture Brothers, right? And I was like, hey, look at this thing I found. And he went, yeah, you can watch it. But major spoilers, right?
Major spoilers.
So I guess my question to you is that, like, when you're watching season one, it's so episodic, and you get very quickly that, like, what happens in one episode will in fact make an appearance in subsequent episodes. Like, if a car crashes through the wall, they said, like, either the hole stays there or they show you that they're going to repair it, right? So it's not like a show where the world resets at the end of every episode. But at the same time, though, everything's so bonkers and can come from every possible direction, it almost feels like it doesn't quite matter what happens, because you get the feeling something's going to happen from another direction anyway. So my big question to you is, why does the continuity matter, and why do the possibilities of spoilers matter in the show, given what we see in season one up to the beginning of season two?
Venture Brothers is a whole lot like X-Files. Some episodes are just like throwaways. Yes. They're funny stories that showcase a character or a relationship. But a lot of episodes are canonical. They're the ones with the cigarette smoking man in them. And
the mythology of the show,
like, yeah, and Ghost of the Sargasso is absolutely one of them, because it establishes who Rusty's dad was, and you know, the foundation of Rusty's absolute shittiness as a person.
Yeah. You're having a nightmare, go back to bed.
but that said, as I told you, when you're watching through, the order doesn't really matter in the first season. You're gonna, you know, you'll see Dr. Orpheus before you're supposed to be introduced to him or whatever, but it doesn't really matter until the story starts to break out in the second season.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where I had you stop is, well, you've already experienced one giant spoiler, right? And a lot of things are going to change from that point forward, and you never stop meeting new people and you never stop loving them. I swear to God, you never do.
Tell me who your favorite character is.
No, let's do this as a thunder round later.
All right, I can do that. All right, fair enough. And the rules are no duplicates. So if your favorite comes up, it's already been called, you got to scramble and find your alternate right quick. Chris, anything else you want to share with us about Ghost of the Sargasso, which is a banger of an episode, by the way? It's really funny.
It's a good one. It's an important one. It's so far from my favorite. It's nowhere near my favorite episode. It's just an important one to me because it's where I started.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And it demonstrates everything about, like, almost from this episode, you can kind of see where season seven is going to leave you.
Season seven. Wow. Yes. Okay. All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to move along to the next moment. So Tom Hespos, why don't you bring us into what your moment of truth is? What episode does it come from? Where did you select it? Why did you select it? All that good stuff.
I think it was just like my first laugh out loud moment. So the episode kicks off, and, you know, speaking of Johnny Quest, like, we're going to kick one off, and there's Race Bannon, and you're like, whoa, whoa. They're like, it's like the first season. They're already going there. Like, they've already acknowledged this is Johnny Quest takeoff, but, like, now they're going to make Race Bannon an actual character.
Meta.
Just like, I'm in the back of my head, I'm like, this thing goes on for like seven or eight seasons. And like, what, like, they're doing this early. Like, what is going on here? And, you know, you see Race Bannon doing like the secret agent thing. He jumps out of an airplane, gets knocked unconscious by the airplane. And the thing that just made me laugh is, like, you know, you see him get, like, you know, he's down on the ground, like, probably dead, but maybe not. And then they go take a break to go deal with a bunch of, like, other plot points. And when they finally get back to Race Bannon, like, the chute is, like, dragging him across the ground because the wind kicked up a little bit. And there are all these, like, neighborhood kids, like, playing with his spy shit.
And riding
and riding his carcass
on the bike with acid, and, like, there's another kid, like, you know, walking around in his boots, and, like, another kid pulls out the pack of spy cigarettes and a flamethrower lighter, and, like, just starts, like, and, like, I just had the biggest freaking belly laugh from that, because it, like, it's exactly what kids would do in that situation.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's like, nobody's showing any concern for the dead guy on the ground, you know, but Like they sure are messy.
It's a bad neighborhood.
Pockets, they're rolling them, like looking for change or whatever, you know. But I just thought that was so hilarious that like that's how, you know, the race Bannon that like I looked up to when I was the Johnny Quest kid, you know, right? That's how he ends up. Like it's just so.
I know. I saw that and thought that's got to be. That I hadn't seen Johnny Quest in forever. I was like, that couldn't be. They're playing off the main character. That wasn't his name, right? And I'm like, that's his freaking name. Like that's literally. Right.
It's like, they no show way. His they ID.
Do that in other episodes. This one, it's like, no, it's really Race Bannon.
Somebody's gonna sue you.
Just to dispel any doubt that yeah, that's Race Bannon. Just,
yeah.
Here's his ID.
Subtle as a chainsaw. Just in case you didn't know.
But what's great is that this Race Bannon. He's a bastard. And you're going to see him again, Tom. You're going to see him again.
I will.
He will appear in flashback. Yeah, but
you see him like throwing a grenade into an airplane. Like the Race Bannon from Johnny Quest would never, you know, completely.
No, yeah, like, he's got blades in his boots.
Yeah.
Like the old lady from that James Bond movie.
Yeah. Yeah. from Russia with Love. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's right.
Like only bad guys do that. The guy's like, ah, you suck.
Yeah.
He's like clearly.
I love it. I can't remember what it is he says.
Yeah.
When he jumps out and he's like something like, yeah, that was all too easy. Bam, plane hits him and I think it goes to the like
you know, like yeah, I mean I think I've said it before in this show. But like when I was a kid, like as a Johnny Quest fan, like I wanted Race Bannon to be my dad. Like I loved Race Bannon. Like he was the coolest guy.
He was so much cooler than Johnny's dad.
Oh my God. So absolutely. So much cooler. So I was like, Race Bannon, they killed Race Bannon. Like,
oh yeah.
What the F, you know? And they didn't
Johnny's
kill
dad
him.
Was always reeling it in, you know. He was okay, everybody, it's getting a little bit out of control. He was the square of the show, yeah.
But they don't just kill Race, right? When they finally get to him, he has his death moment, and then like Race soils himself on the street.
Yeah, they don't show you that part in TV.
Yeah.
Just gratuitous.
Wow,
gratuitous.
Like, I just think they really defiled him.
Oh yeah,
that's so hard. You didn't have to go that way, guys. Come on, man.
I want to spoil something for you
so
bad. What
I'm laughing over because it's just like it's an obscure reference after obscure reference, yeah. And you're just like, it comes so rapid fire, but it's not like, you know, Letterkenny or something like that where you could just roll with it. It's just like, holy crap! Like your mind is continually blown by like just how many really obscure. Like 70s references they're throwing at you. And like, there is only a small narrow window of folks who are going to like appreciate all of this. And it's aimed right at us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It just one thing after another hits you. And it's just like, holy crap. Like I my brain's starting to get tired because I'm accessing bits of information that haven't been accessed in 30 years plus, you know, like what is going on here?
Yeah.
More like 40.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of mental whiplash going on. Like, well, wait a minute. You know, the thing I loved about their just ignoble dispatching of Race, like they bring him up to us just so they can take him away again. When this episode came out, like Adult Swim's library of shows, wasn't that huge. Right. And a lot of the ones they had were like these Hanna-Barbera like self parodies where they took like stock footage from the show, like Harvey Birdman. And Space Ghost Coast to Coast. Like they took these shows that were cool, but manifestly a little goofy to begin with and kind of really asking to be parodied. And so it was funny to watch them do that. And you kind of got like, yeah, this is a pretty good use for the show. I don't know anybody out there certainly at the time who was like, you know, it could really use a good takedown. Johnny Quest, like people still had this reverence for it, you know, so they're like, let's just puncture that balloon right now and we'll do it with the character we know you all love the most, Race Bannon. like that just took such courage, right? But they did it in a way that wasn't, I don't know, like maybe you guys can help me kind of contextualize this, but like this is such a good example of how they're lampooning the source material without mercy. And yet they still kind of, you can still see that they love it. Like, how is that?
They savage it and they love it.
It's tender.
Yeah. How are they doing that? Like, Chris, as a professional storyteller, you tell me, man, like, how are they pulling this magic trick off? Because I don't know too many other shows that have done this level of parody while also maintaining a genuine affection for the thing that they're that they're parodying, but at the same time acknowledging an inherent ridiculousness to it. They thread that needle really, really deftly. And I just don't know how they're doing it.
That actually kind of goes into what I was going to, part of what I was going to talk about with my moment of truth. So I don't want to, I don't want to,
then you'll,
I'm going to get to that in a minute. But yeah, I've got a partial answer, and I want help from the rest of y'all. I want to hear what Chris says too. But yeah, it's definitely, it's how do you thread that needle of being both savage and
perfect,
admiring? So yeah,
there's an episode in season two or three where Rusty's going to therapy with former boy adventurers and their sidekicks, and the Hardy Boys are there.
Oh wow. Jesus.
Those kids are messed up.
And those kids are messed up.
Nancy Drew show up too. I mean,
Nancy Drew shows up. She's all like gothed out and
you meet characters named Nancy and Drew.
Yeah.
They're twins.
Sweet.
Different episode.
That's awesome.
That's so good.
It's great. But they do the Hardy Boys with the Menendez brothers.
Oh my God.
And that's I brought it up because that's the kind of like loving savagery that they have.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
You know, like, oh, that's vicious and kind of credible.
Yeah. I do see it. I do see it. I don't have to go that far to actually get there. I get it. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, that's so good. So Tom, you know, the moment where the kids are poking it at Race. And by the way, that moment reminded me of is if you've ever seen The Wild Bunch, the beginning where all those kids are poking at the skeleton. There's a scorpion being attacked by ants, and these vicious kids like poking at the scorpion as a way of telling you like this world is a savage world. Like I got that Peckinpah kind of vibe when these kids are just like rolling Race for all of his stuff. You know, they're like riding him like a train. The fact that they chose Race and I mean, it's such a great moment, but like, are there any other kind of moments like that in the season that you've seen up to so far that kind of hit you with that kind of like lightning bolt intensity where you're like, that's Race Bannon, what the hell?
I chose that because it was like the first really big belly laugh that I got out of the show. There were other moments like that, including the tag sale episode where I just like, I could not stop laughing. but we'll probably get into that a little bit.
That's his own Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yeah, a couple of, you know, like recognition. I mean, there were recognition moments in like every episode, you know, just like if not a character, then like a vibe that like went along with the show. So like, you know, the Sargasso, the geek that gave off strong Johnny Quest vibes, like from the very beginning. And you're like, holy crap. Like
well, the rest of the episode you're talking, you know, they do that to Race Bannon. And then the rest of the episode is a complete parody of the Fantastic Four, which is another like beloved franchise.
And holy crap, is it vicious.
But like, at the end of the episode, or maybe it was the beginning of the next episode, they go on to like sort of pat one another on the back about how good a facsimile of the Fantastic Four that they were. So like, what's it, either Dean or Hank, one of them says like, they were a pretty Fantastic Four, you know. That was another belly laugh. I was like, oh my
God. Tell you what though, this episode gets credit for, they were calling out the absolute horrible, like, worst fictional husband ever, Reed Richards.
They're
calling that out before the internet kind of got hip to it, just how awful Reed Richards was, especially like in the first 100 issues of that comic.
Yeah,
and he's saying stuff to Sue that like you just can't say, like you really shouldn't have been saying them back in 1965, let alone now. But and Stephen Colbert voicing him, which is such a treat.
Oh my God, that's who. Oh.
That was Stephen Colbert as Dr. Impossible.
That makes it even better,
right?
And he has a pipe, and I'm like, this is the whole.
it's so good, Chris. Please tell me we see more of these guys as the show goes.
Oh my
on.
God, they're all major characters. They all of them are there forever. All of them. Everybody.
Later,
stays.
Do they parody any of the other like really awful Marvel shows? Because like we saw the Fantastic Four, I feel like I got a little glimpse of a Spider-Man vibe in an episode. Like,
yeah,
they go after like Thor and the Hulk and like all those other.
They go after Spider-Man. They go after the Avengers, but it's kind of a low rent Avengers. There's no Although, no, there's a Hulk. There is a Hulk. There's a Red Hulk. You see the Legion of Doom.
Outstanding.
Sort of.
Like, those first cartoons just have, like, this vibe to them I can't even describe. But, like, every time they parody it, they just nail it perfectly every time.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to see it over and over. Oh, and, man. Oh, I envy you. Your journey.
what a treat. Absolutely adore it. I think we're going to move on. So, Chris, why don't you bring us to your moment of truth and talk us through the point of the show, where it is, give us an idea of what's actually happening. But then, you know, again, like with Tom, let us know why this moment is the prism through which you see the show.
When Chris Crenshaw suggested the show, and I had never heard of it, there's a long text. They're like, okay, look, start here. Like, I clearly got, okay, Chris loves this and knows this deep, like deep stuff.
So it's shorter watching than the original version of Chris.
I'm sure. and I started watching the first couple episodes, and I'm thinking, what the hell, what is this? Like, what? At first, I'm like, okay, it's silly, it's funny. And I'm not a super serious, self-serious, like, I mean, yeah, I like Moby Dick. I like, you know, I like comic book. Like, I can't even say comic books anymore because those are serious too. But I watch bad kung fu movies, if there are such a thing. Like, I watch everything and read everything. Like, at first I thought this is just sort of like these guys are trying to do something kind of like South Park, and they're not doing it really well, until I get to episode 4, Home Insecurity. And maybe before then, and because it wasn't like, I think this is bad. I'm like, okay, I get what they're doing with the characters, I think. And yet I was surprised by all kinds of things that happened later. But Home Insecurity, it really started hitting its vibe. And that's when Brock's like, I gotta go camping, Doc, you know this. Like, you couldn't leave at a worse time. And and Brock goes out in the woods and then goes camping. And I'll get to that moment in a minute. But everything was stupidly funny. The kids wake up and they're in like underoos, like in what, and one of them, Hank, I don't know if it's Dean or Hank, I get them mixed. Dean's wearing like the Aquaman underoos.
Yeah, Hank's got Aquaman.
Dean's got Dean's got Spider-Man. I think that's when we first meet Dr. Underbite, and like the prelude to the show, and you're like, okay, that's Dr. Doom, but not. And this right. is, and he's talking to like his minions, and like, that's totally Dr. Evil. And they one up that, and like the whole tiger bomb, like it's a horrible
girl Hitler.
Horribly stupid. Girl Hitler. Pun.
Yeah.
Girl Hitler. She's the best.
So funny. Girl Hitler.
Like, and really?
Oh, a tiger bomb. I mean, like, that's such a horrible pun. And I laughed at that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Same.
Like, and then Brock enough to kill them, but then I don't know. Go ahead.
No, Brock. Bomb. Brock goes out camping, and somebody he sees something in the woods, and he's like, "Who's there?" And he gets his hunting knife and throws it like a ninja star, and starts chasing this thing. He's wounded, and suddenly the f-ing $6 million man leaps out of a tree in the slow mo, and then you're like, "It's Sasquatch." And he's like, "Wait, you're." I was like, what is happening? It's like every
not only has somebody never made a $6 million reference, you know, and the man reference in these things, but like, you got to go pretty deep into $6 million man to get to Bionic Sasquatch.
Right. But I remember that episode. Yes, I watched it as a kid. This is just, that was as iconic to me as Bugs Bunny when I was 7 or 8.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you see,
he was my favorite toy.
Then you're like, what do they do? What's their explanation of them being in the world? Okay, they're not going to have an explanation.
They have a beautiful relationship. They come up with an explanation.
I know. They do. He's like, and I just took one look at a Sasquatch. I'm like, what the hell is
Squatchy here. Sassy.
And you're and Brock is like, he does like that one eye, like that Popeye thing. He's like, I'm uncomfortable. Don't know how to handle it. Let alone when he has to shave him later. He didn't tell me Sasquatch is a dude. Nothing you haven't seen before. This Sasquatch is something I haven't seen before. Brock's having a meltdown. That's when I teach satire. I do a thing in satire with my seniors and in my AP class. And I mean, satire is usually set up to like derogate and
deride and diminish some real world thing. And it can be done just for laughs, but usually there's something more serious for purpose to it. And that's when I was thinking this was like South Park. South Park mostly just turns everything on its head and is like, everything's stupid. I'm being really simplistic here.
Yeah.
But it's like
South Park's an agent of chaos. Yeah.
Yes. It napalms everything.
Yeah.
Right. And this show's got a pretty, like, as Tom mentioned and Chris earlier, but it's got this sort of niche audience. It's got this slice of time. It's kind of a big one. I mean, it's from like the 60s through the 80s, and then there's other references to later, but sort of that time period. And yet it does it in a way where
Jesus, like, Jones.
Yes. And then you get the $6 million man Sasquatch are in love. And at the end, they're like, we're going to go up to Canada. Sasquatch got some relatives up there. And so they disappear. And you're like, okay. So they're going to go have like a nice, happy. Instead of painting.
Like, the painting.
Yes. The painting.
Sasquatch made Brock a painting. It's lovely.
And it's.
It gives me.
But it captures also like the absurdity of the whole show. Like the minions from the Monarch. And who's like the most self-deluded villain in history.
Right.
And Dr. Unterbite are arguing over who's going to like go kill Dr. Venture. And they're like, and neither of them can succeed. And the boys are stupidly like not
GED.
What are we going to do? How am I going to do that? I don't know, but that looks like a door. Like stupid throwaway lines like that where you're like, oh my god, these people are completely I hope Brock shows up so they don't all die. And it's freaking Helper. It's the like robotic broomstick, by the way, whose feelings are hurt because Dr. Right. Venture is creating a new security robot. And it's like me like
I love this episode for Helper. They make you feel all the empathy in the world for the robot that can't talk.
Right, but he loves him, and he gets like a little stick and like a hobo from the 1930s in a cartoon. And like goes, and he's like at the bus stop, and he hears like, and then
like he can Venture get on a bus.
Dr. Venture finally is like, Helper, you know, the boys need you, or something. And Helper's like, me, me, like, go, all right, and he like ditches the hobo pack and like runs back, and right. This is all like runs back to help, and you're like, this really is? Okay. This is the most dysfunctional family I've ever met.
Yeah.
And they're so much damn fun. And Brock's like, what the is going on here? Like, that's kind of this whole right. So he's kind of like Ray Spannon, where he's got to like clean everything up. It's that whole I'm trying to find one moment. It's probably when $6 million man showed up in Sasquatch. I was like, okay, this is just completely going off the rails, but they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's making fun. It's trying to make fun of the stuff and go see, this is kind of ludicrous and silly, but we also know you guys are nostalgic for the stuff and we are too. And so we love it. We're going to make fun of it. And we're going to like show you like Reed Richards is awful, right? He's an awful human being in many ways.
You know? No word.
And from that episode on, I was like, okay, I am fully embracing just the ludicrousness and the off-the-wall absurdity, because these guys, they know exactly what they're doing. They love what they're doing. They have all these, they know the stuff they're parodying, and yet they're doing it lovingly. You know, that the henchman like hanging out, so that's how I was either joined the army or become a henchman. Right. I don't know.
Monarch saved my life.
I like that with the voice of that one guy who sounds like a stupider Ray Romano. Like he just cracks me up every
day. Yes. 24. Yes, yeah.
24. Oh my god, he's so funny.
I think that's the one that gets what he thinks is the lightsaber.
Yeah,
it's like you and Brock Simpson. We meet
21 gets the lightsaber. Yeah. 21, that's 21. Isn't that 21 was 21.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
24.
Another one's like, shut up,
shut up.
Like, find out it's not quite a lightsaber, not quite the lightsaber that he imagined from his youth. Yeah.
Dude, they compare him to Ray Romano in show.
Oh God,
in show.
That's awesome.
I'm not the only one. That's what makes this show so fun. Oh my god, you're like, is that?
Oh,
you
know, man.
Like, you're never quite sure because these are all fuzzy memories we've had to call on, guys. Like,
yeah.
You should also be aware that the master, Dr. Orpheus's mystic master, is played by Archer.
Oh god.
And he's one of the best characters in the whole show. He's hilarious the whole time.
Chris has been vibrating this whole time. Like, he's been like in his seat, just like humming with energy. He's like so excited. One of the things that I noticed when I watch these episodes is that they're remarkably dense. Right. Like, there's not a wasted moment, and it's not quite like His Girl Friday, like rapid fire, but it, everything, I mean, there's no gaps between any comedic element. It's so perfectly suited. And yet the episodes never really feel overstuffed, you know? And so Chris Swan, from like a plotting perspective, I'd love to get, you know, I know you know a thing or two about plotting. What is, like, when you watch these episodes and how tightly written they're done, despite the nuttiness of it all, how does it make you feel as a writer just to see these things unfold the way that they do?
It's amazing. I was stunned and looked. I was like, okay, I got to watch a few of these yesterday and today to catch up. I was like, oh my God, there's so much. I'd forgotten how short they are. It doesn't feel long. Like, I don't feel like, oh my God, when is this going to end? It's just, oh my God, it's only like 24 minutes.
Yeah.
It does come rapid fire. There aren't any scenes that are complete losers. I think Rusty Venture is probably, of all the characters, he's the one that I least like. But there are times when I do like him. Sometimes when he is funny, but usually they have him with some other character. It might be Brock or whoever. Every scene just adds something, even if it's a throwaway, like at the tag sale with Monarch talking to Dr. Girlfriend. And I'm like, of course, he gets the beautiful girlfriend who talks like this. You know, it sounds like Thug Number 3 from The Godfather Part 2.
And yeah,
you smoke six packs a day. See what you sound like.
They're really like perfect timing comedians. It'd be really easy to get really indulgent in some of the stuff in the sense of just, let's just keep running with the same joke. No, we got to cut back to this.
Yeah.
We got to jump around. We got to jump all around. Yeah. And yet it does tie together. And the nice thing about the show, even though there is some continuity from one episode to the other, the one with the Ice Station Impossible, which I love because Ice Station Zebra is one of my favorite books, the movies and that. It ends with, the Sue Storm character's like, I'm going to go get my bag. And, you know, I'm going to run off with Dr. Venture. And Brock's like, and then she does. And Brock looks at Venture's like, so you want to, like, and he's like, yeah, let's go. End of episode. Like, no. There's, and I'm like, the next episode, she's not showing back. She'll come back later. They'll all come back later, as Chris has suggested. But it's okay. We're done with that for now.
Yeah.
And that's the beautiful part.
Yeah.
It is. Look, Chris, its mythos, its universe grows so organically. It reminds me of Tolkien in a really stupid way. Like, I can't even believe I'm saying it, but you know, they keep giving you these hints of unexplored vistas, like Movie Night.
Yeah.
And then Tolkien always goes and shows you what that is and what's behind that. And that's why I love Tolkien. That kind of stuff just gets me. That kind of storytelling is what draws me in.
I agree. I think also the thing with Tolkien, if I remember, I know this is simplistic because it's such a huge topic, but you know, he's telling The Hobbit to his son Christopher, and he wanted to know other things, and so he's like, well, now I got to come up with. And so then he comes up with, and he already had bits and pieces. Then he came up, he's like, oh, now I got to justify to myself this whole world, so let me go and tell this enormous companion. So I wonder with this show how much of it they're like, okay, we're gonna have 8 seasons or whatever. Or if they just did it and then later they're like, we keep that.
I had read that by the later seasons, the co-creators were going back and looking at fan wikis to make sure that they weren't making continuity errors on their own material, because at that point the fandom was so ardent. They're like, well, we can't screw this up, you know. And they were actually doing,
that's why I expect such high things from the new movie.
Yeah.
<I'm so excited. laughs> but I don't feel prepared yet to watch the movie. Like, I've only seen, like, again, season one and then the very beginning of season two.
At this point, I'm committing myself to binging through the whole rest of the series just so I can be ready to go. Kind of like, you know, I'm actually in a place like when the Breaking Bad finale was coming and people were like all in a lather about it, I'm like, well, I might as well go on a bender on Breaking Bad so I can see what the rest of the world's talking about. And I just watched the entire show up until that point.
Yeah, I'm in for the rest of it too. Oh my God.
Yeah, for sure.
So. Just some of those belly laugh, like that tag sale episode. Like, I just could not believe how like that just built up until I just exploded. Like, underbite having to go through the metal detector.
I can't unsee that.
Yeah,
I can taste it. I got water under my tongue.
Like, they're all recoiling from it.
He's, having all his old arch nemesis come back, to file his old crap, and then you know something funny is gonna happen, and then he's going through the metal detector, like all these things are building up, and then like finally it's like we need a distraction, and they're like, these guys within 3 seconds of saying that, they're all fighting each other and they're fighting like exceptionally dirty, it was so great. Like,
yeah,
it took so long to build up to that moment though. Like,
yeah.
I just started laughing hysterically when they started fighting.
That is probably my favorite episode of the first season. Every like little background character you're going to see again one way or another. And part of that was just frugality, because they were recycling animation assets.
Sure. Yeah.
But they use it so well and so intentionally.
You can't tell to invest in this world the way that they do. Right. So deeply. I mean, like, I can see there's a Tolkien level just investment in the world they're crafting. Compared to what Tolkien was doing. And Tolkien was, he was creating this mythology that went back an enormous amount of time and drawing upon all these sources. They were doing just as deep a dive back into their own pop culture history. I mean, and there's a reason why we keep laughing about all these hyper obscure references that come out. I mean, like during the Christmas episode, right? And Dean's reading from that Necronomicon, and he's reading from it and these magical utterings, and they cut away from him and they come back and he goes, "Doth feel the envy." I'm like, holy shit, that's from Excalibur. Like, it's 2 seconds, right? Blink and you miss it. But that's how much they're mining our collective pop culture
and
history.
There were so many people just like us who were like, yes!
Yeah, we're like, yes,
as soon as we saw that, and it moves on, right?
Yeah, it moves on. But like you can't fake that. You can't hand wave that. You can't just half-ass that. That requires an immense dedication to the subject matter. And so I get the Tolkien reference, and I think it's a really fair one, to be honest. And I think a lot of Tolkien fans may not like, elevating this to the level of Tolkien, but as far as, as far as like creative craftsmanship goes, I see a certain equity there. They do different things with their work, but as far as like the amount of themselves they pour into the work, I think there's the
detail to constructing a world, whereas Tolkien is like creating languages first, and then I'm going to sort of justify that.
Yeah.
On top of a bedtime story I was telling my kid, these guys are building stories off of pop culture,
the dreams we all had as children.
Right. You know? And then we're going to,
right? Or the language of our dreams.
Right. They're doing it in completely different ways, but in terms of how deeply they get into it and the same level there.
And it's postmodern. It's as postmodernist as a Hydra,
All right, so I'm going to skip to my moment of truth. The 13th episode of season one starts with one of the most, like, Tom, you're talking about your race band and belly laugh. My biggest belly laugh was when Brock Samson has to bring Dr. Venture back to the ER after they've already had this like Scooby-Doo escapade gone horribly wrong in this movie theater that like they're all dressed as Rocky Horror Picture Show, fans. And it's clear that like something's gone horribly wrong. And Brock has murdered some people. And you turn this like movie theater into a slaughterhouse, and they cut away to the ER, and all these people dressed as Rocky Horror fans are there nursing horrible injuries. Right. And they're like all messed up. It's like, "Doc, we got to get you back." And like, and they wheel away Dr. Venture, and Brock can't follow, so he turns and goes back to the ER, and he walks in. Everybody's like, "Oh," and everybody just clears out, right? They see Brock and they just run. But like, they never actually, like, this is a great, like, when they talk about, like, show don't tell, they don't actually tell us everything that happened. We just, it's like, and Chris, you talk about how this is a very lived in world, right?
Yeah.
And how, like, this is like we know by this point, we know enough of all these characters what has happened.
We know what Brock did.
Why they were there. We know what Brock did. We know how bad it was. It's like, it's just, I laughed so hard. So I'm like, I got 20% of the story, but I have 100% of the story. Like it was killing me. So I was laughing so hard off of that opening joke that by the time we get to the rather shocking end of the episode, spoiler alert. Okay, everybody here, spoiler alert. You know what happens is Hank and Dean actually get murdered by Henshin's 21 and 24. We kind of kill them sort of by accident. You know,
yeah, it's a total accident.
But they still shotgun them as like a drive-by, right? And they die, and the episode, you know, ends as abruptly as they all do, you know, with Dr. Venture go, okay, get their clothes. And it just cuts to this sad song. You're like, what the F happened, right?
Well, who is that song in the style of, Tom? Was that like a Nickelback song or something?
I was getting John Denver vibes off of it because it was okay. Like so like acoustic. Like I was getting like a 1970s kind of like sad post Vietnam mopey America kind of vibe off.
Fair,
that too.
Fair.
You know, but what I'm getting to is that it's like, okay, so since I'm streaming this, I didn't have to wait like 2 years or whatever people had to wait in between seasons for Rich Brothers, right? Dude. So I just go right on to the next one. And this is my moment of truth, which is I'm like, okay, more mayhem. Let's do this. And the cold open is complete, like tonal shift. They use the song "Everybody's Free to Feel Good," right? Which is like this like rave.
Everybody's free
to feel good. Yeah, it's like banger from like 2002, right? It was like, you know, the EDM song.
Hit, yeah,
yeah. It was so huge. Here's what's happened to everybody since we last left them. And it was a continuity nod that I was not expecting in the show at all. And it was actually kind of touching and kind of real, right? So it starts off, we see Brock digging the graves of the boys. We then cut to White and Quiz Boy giving Venture Jr. his robot hand, right? And he's like, yeah, I got a hand. Like, we did it, yay! And like, oh, that's kind of cool. Even though Venture Jr. is a bastard, you're like, you feel good for them, right? And then it goes to Orpheus, like crying over breakfast because he let the boys die, and Triana is like comforting her dad, right? It's like this human moment, and you know, mm-hmm. and she's like, it's okay, dad, like holds his arm. And then we move to Phantom Lim moving over and kissing Dr. Girlfriend on the head, and she kind of looks out the window like, this is not where I wanted my relationship to be, and like she's made a regretful choice and that she's not happy where she is. And then we see the Monarch in jail, he's not happy, and then like a butterfly lands and he eats the butterfly. Just like, thank you, Monarch. So good, right? But then we cut to 21 and 24 blowing up the cocoon. Like they had that list he gave them. He gave them like that preposterous list to do. And one of them was kill the Venture Brothers, right? But like, you know, you see the cocoon explode and like, okay, checked off. And like, and you feel bad. The cocoon exploded. Like, oh man, like I don't want to see that. We had some fun times there, man. Like you don't want to see it get knocked over. And then it gets to this extended sequence where Dr. Venture himself is like, he's distraught, and he jumps in the X2 and just flies around the world, going to all these different places trying to find himself. And like, and Brock is chasing him. Like he goes to like drug addled spots where he can kind of, you know,
he goes to an opium den and the Hungry Like a Wolf video.
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah. Oh, yeah. So he's like in the Amazon, and all of a sudden they cut to the Hunger Like the Wolf thing. I'm like, that's Forget funny. That. Like they couldn't stop. They even still, they're like, you know, we're going to give you a Duran Duran reference just to remind you where you are, right? It's so hilarious.
Well, this gets too serious and sad.
Yeah, before it gets too heavy. Like we get that. I'm like, oh, thank you guys. It was heavier than the show I thought could get. But when I watched it, I remember what you were telling me, Chris, which you're like, yeah, this show is really funny and it's really goofy, but like it gets like, after the first couple seasons, like when the story starts to really layer upon itself, it really hockey sticks in terms of like your investment in these characters. And that's what knocked me out, which is like the way the first season plays out. And even though there's continuity, the episodes are so madcap and they're so goofy and things happen without clear like consequences as to like how people got out of these situations, you know, like that time when like Paul and Underbite get left behind in that right. That guy's thing, like,
or Rusty's in three pieces at the end of one.
Yeah, right. You're like these things resolve, but they resolve off stage in time for the next episode. Yeah. So you kind of get used to that. And these are things that didn't resolve, right? And they stayed unresolved. And all of a sudden, it's like it was like the show is telling us it's okay to love these characters because we love them too. And that was something I was not expecting from the show. And that for me instantly elevated it above anything else I'd ever seen on Adult Swim, because those shows never had the courage to actually love their characters the way this show clearly loves its characters. And that, like, if I didn't love the show before, I sure as hell loved it then. That cold open was like, it blew me away. And I've gone back and I've watched like five other times. And it's funny, when I researched it, you see just various forums, and a lot of fans are like, that's my favorite moment of the entire show ever. It was that season two cold open. It was just such a cool, yeah, unexpected moment. And I was like, you know, only the show could have an episode like Brock and the Sasquatch, and then turn around and give us this kind of cold open and not completely suffer like fatal split personality and like completely just fall apart at the seams. It still maintains its core. And I will marvel at how this show juggles those elements. So that's my moment of truth for the show, is that cold open.
And then we're going to talk about the secret that we find out about the boys.
No, we absolutely can. So
I think it's fine too. I think that's table stakes for Venture Brothers.
I think so, because so what we learn is that the boys died, and Dr. Orpheus is like distraught. He is not forgiven himself for the boys dying, and
he's crushed.
And he's like, I'm a necromancer, I can bring them back. And like, at one point, like, Venture and like Brock are kind of laughing at him, like, oh my god, we just gotta tell him, this poor guy. I was like, yeah, no. turns out these kids have died 14 times before, and they're just clones, and like, they just, they, you know, because
you have death prone kids, yeah, I've got keep death a couple clones kids around the lab.
Exactly, you know.
See, that's the thing about it, is because that so easily could have been like, that could have been in the realm of, oh, it was all just a dream.
Yeah.
Like, it could have been so easy, like, right, oh, you guys, like, you made, yeah, me care about, yeah, them, and it's really just a joke, except, yeah, they did make us care about them and the other characters in the show character. And they, yeah, Orpheus is, yeah, distraught, his daughter's, yeah, like, it's okay, like you were saying. I remember that, and I was like, god, oh my god, like, I mean I'm a high school English teacher, I cry at sunsets and supermarket openings, but I got all teary-eyed watching that.
Yeah.
And then they're like, I'm like, why are they being so freaking casual? Yeah, they clone them. Okay, you got me, and that was good. It would have been so easy for that to have just gone completely sideways, and like, okay, now now you're just manipulating me, and it's stupid. It was more like, you got me, and that was what are they gonna do now?
Yeah,
there's more layers to it, Chris.
That's
such a good question.
Yeah, no, this show is layers all the way down, right?
Yeah,
but the thing I loved about the cloning thing is that, like, first of all, it's shocking. You see Brock and Venture legitimately upset that the boys are dead, right? But then once it kind of wears off, like, but it's okay, more where that came from. And they start like having this like funny remembrance when they're talking to Orpheus, like how the other 14 pairs died, and like, and they're like, oh yeah, that was a good one. Like, what the
yes.
Right, you know, and
you're gonna see more of those too.
It can allow us to feel the weight of losing these characters as a bad moment, and at the same time make it so ridiculous that it doesn't forget the comedy of the show, but then it takes that very same thing and turns it back around in this commentary. And, well, what kind of guy is Venture, right? Like, you know, this is the sins of the father paying it forward.
Yeah.
He was abused by his father. He's abusing his kids by not letting them die once. Like, he still keeps them around so they can experience these things again and again and again and again and again. And it's, and at the same time, you're like, why did he run away the first time? Because he knows that, like, what happened to his kids could have happened to him. You know, and like, there's, this is so circular, and it's way more layered than you would expect. I mean, this is really nuanced, and
it goes into season seven. That is yeah, the path, and it's like, oh, yeah, it's a wheel that rolls. It's so good.
Yeah. Beneath all that surface level maniacal humor, there's like a real story being told there, and real things being brought up, and they actually had the courage to include those things, because once you start including those things, usually the comedy dies, and I've got no confidence at all that the comedy is going to die here.
Right. No, I wouldn't count on that. No.
Yeah.
That's why I want to watch the rest of it. Just part, yeah, of me wants to see it just because it's hysterical. And part of me wants to watch it as a craftsman or wannabe craftsman to see, like, yeah, how do they do this?
Yeah. Right. Like, yeah,
how do they do exactly what you're talking about, Bill? How do you continually balance that without ruining one or the other?
Yeah. Right? I mean, because we've seen so many shows try it and fail. We have a little bit more time left. Let's do that thunder round on who our favorite characters are, shall we? Chris Crenshaw, why don't you start with who your favorite character in the show is?
Okay, I'm going to leave some low-hanging fruit on the ground, because I know who Chris wants to pick. And I'm going to tell you Sergeant Hatred.
And we don't see him yet. I've read about him though.
Sergeant Hatred is—he really only appears starting in season two. And once the Monarch is put away, Dr. Venture needs a new archenemy. Sergeant Hatred is assigned by the Guild, and Sergeant Hatred is an ex-soldier, an ex-super soldier, like he's a Captain America analog, and he's also a recovering pedophile, and.
Remember reading that going, okay.
And he's on a drug called No Molestol. Yeah. and you know, like when Hank and Dean come to his housewarming party, he's like, "No, you got to get those beautiful boys away from here." He's also got my favorite single line from probably the entire show when he first shows up to the Venture compound. He's like making his entrance. I'm your new arch enemy. He shoots Rusty with a non-lethal round, and Rusty's like bleeding. He's like, oh, we gotta go full nerf here, we got a bleeder. and then as they leave, he's like, anybody hungry? I think there's an Obon Pain on the way home. Obon Pain. Whenever I walk past one in a train station or an airport, I say it out loud. Obon Pain.
One day someone's going to turn around with their eyes and be like,
yeah.
Yeah, like, just like us.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're going to be like, oh my God. You're
going to throw your free baguette like a baton.
Right
there. Hey, thank you. That's so good.
And he'll look exactly like me. Yeah.
Tom Hespo's favorite character.
Oh God, it's got to be Orpheus. Oh my God!
All right,
Chris wanted
another big belly laugh. Again, like is you know, like everything he says is like the you know, you hear the music in the background and it's like the evil guy like confessing his plan right before the commercial break. You know?
Yeah,
it's like, and like you just go, "Who wants pizza rolls?" And it's like the music's playing, and like I just could not stop laughing. Like I just, his character is so great, and like
all the
parallels to like Doctor Strange and everything. There's a lot of complexity there. I mean, like. They're both kind of treated like a joke, even though they might be the most powerful guy in the room, but like you just get treated like a joke anyway, you know, if you're the master of the mystic arts.
There's a great moment at the end of season one when he's following Hank and Dean as they're out there and they're in that diner, and he gets harassed by those two like homophobic rednecks
who are
like big, and then you see this like green light and like light up the diner. He just like annihilates them.
He traps their souls in homeboy figurines.
Don't touch that. It's got two redneck ne'er-do-wells or whatever. It's like, what the heck's going on here? It's so funny.
Yay! Thou have smelt it. I have dealt it.
Dynamic going on with his voice and everything like that, and he's trying to have a sex talk with his daughter. With his daughter.
Oh God!
It's like your maidenhead is protected. It's like, Dad, please.
Oh God, Dad.
No, God, Dad. Triana just wants to die. It's like, please stop.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, he's surprisingly domestic, right? It's like a single dad trying to make it work. You know,
there are three puddings in the refrigerator. You may have the contents of one.
Was that skull like people who use their answering machine to leave messages for people who are home already?
I wasn't sure how it worked.
Like, I think that's what that was, and that's damn obscure.
But it was also clearly the bat phone from the mayor's office in the Adam West show.
Oh, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was.
And she comes in as like, you know, just opens it up. It's like, okay, they play the message. Like, you're playing a message out of a skull. What are you?
Her dad's a necromancer, you know, you get used to it.
But the other thing I love about Orpheus is that he's renting a unused little corner of the Venture compound. Like, he's on the property.
He's a necromancer. He lives in our backyard.
He's constantly being made to do favors for Dr. Venture to get like breaks on the rent and stuff, right? Like,
a lot.
The only reason why he's watching these boys all the time.
He desperately, desperately wants a villain.
It's hard to
like, Chris. Mine, I'm Dr. Orpheus, like shoots magic bolts, everybody. If you wish to come take your revenge on me, here's my card. Yeah. Only at night.
Only at night it takes off.
Well, I can't wait for you guys to meet the Order of the Triad, because it's a thing of beauty. You get to meet Jefferson Twilight Blackula Hunter.
Oh, I can't wait for it. So, Chris Swan, who's your favorite character now that we've already taken Dr. Orpheus from you?
It's got to be Brock. Triana is a minor, like she's off to the side. I really like her because she's just like, what?
Like, she's so honest. Yeah, she's a
badass, but Brock is just completely over the top. The episode where you meet Orpheus, which is, I love that episode just because you meet Orpheus, you meet Molotov Cocktease, you meet Triana, and they're in the joy can, which is the stupidest and therefore most perfect name for that.
Why does it lock on the inside?
Yeah.
Come on, think about it. You're like, God, Rusty, you're just such a schmuck. And Brock gets stuck in it, and like his fantasy is dressing up and like a Native American, like the worst parody of, and he's this huge, tall, what is he called, the Swedish killing machine in like episode one. Imagine that with like face paint, and that's, you're like, this is just wrong on so many levels.
Yeah.
And he's just being perpetually assaulted by and killing ninjas and a cowboy riding a T-Rex, and like that's his fan, that's his happy place.
Yeah, it's just an endless smorgasbord of fantasy violence.
but they make him right. He can actually treat Hank and every once in a while, he's like, you're a good kid, Hank.
Oh,
even when they're like, yeah, that was,
he loves those boys. He loves them deeply.
He does. And there are times in season one, he's almost like the moral center of that family, oddly enough.
Yeah, and which is really troubling.
He's the one giving one giving the kids you haven't seen it yet, but it, the third episode of season two, when he's going off to do a mission, he's giving Hank and Dean a lice check before he leaves. He is a mom.
Dean, like the plane full of snake guys crashes and burns in there, and they're like, what are we doing? We're looking for clues. And Dean's like, I think I know why the plane crashed. It was being driven by skeletons. He's like, yeah, that's really good. Good job, kid. He could have been like, Rusty would have been like, what are you, a moron?
Yeah,
and
right.
He's like, that's you did good. Now shut up before I stroke out.
Reasons are nature's
snake
candy.
Guy, by the way, how many episodes later is it that he pops out of the freaking plane when talk about callbacks? I mean, oh my God.
They put him in situations where it's like, okay, I can kill anybody with my knife. And then he has to do things like shave the Sasquatch, and he's like all freaked out. But like, they make him, they put him in uncomfortable places, and I like that. So he's not just, not just the killing machine. Yeah. And he is. He's their stand-in mom.
He's kind of the viewer's stand-in in this universe. He's the guy that sees everything as absurd as it is. You know,
what kind of stupid shit do I have to deal with now?
Yeah. Right.
he's the closest thing we're going to get to a detached observer to this universe. You know, he's unrattled by it more than anybody, I guess, which is what brings him closest to us. So
right,
I'll tell you, my favorite is Dr. Girlfriend. I adore Dr. Girlfriend so much
because about her,
her crazy, like, you know, like Harvey Firestein voice, like, yeah, I'm with the monarch. He's arching Dr. Venture now. Like, just like that the horrible voice that's been smoked to smithereens. She's just kind of hilarious. Like, you appreciate the fact, like, she's hanging around with this loser of a boyfriend, right? And like, and like in a tag sale, like, all these other people kind of come up to her, like, you could break out on your own, man. Like, I'd like to be your number two. Like, you could be a standalone supervillain, you know? And she's like, yeah, no, I'm okay. Like, she's settled, right? And
I'm in a good place, right?
Yeah, yeah, I'm in a good place, you know? I'm sure you guys one day will find a very happy person who will make, you know.
I mean, the monarch's in the back going, that noise wasn't me. Like, he's in the toilet complaining about the porta potty.
Yeah, blasting at that porta potty.
He's so venal and awful. What does she see in him? She has the best girlfriend ever. She's got a doctorate in it, evidently.
Yeah. I mean, she's fantastic, you know. And during that one episode, Midlife Chrysalis, when Dr. Venture gets she seduces Dr. Venture and he gets turned into like a big caterpillar.
When the monarch's masturbating to it.
Yeah, like it's all so gross and twisted, right? It's so nasty. But like, she's in the middle of this plot. She clearly would rather not be part of, right? And she's like, I'm crossing my own lines here for my boyfriend. This is nuts. And like, finally, like near the end, she like gives Venture this tender kiss on the head and like zaps him to like kind of restore him. And like, there's just a humanity to her that I really enjoy. Like, she's in her own way. She's just this little tiny oasis of sanity in this deeply insane world. But then like there are times when she's like, she tries to use her sex as a weapon and it never seems to work. Like the whole time, like Brock Sampson busts into a room and she's like, oh, you're here for me. She's like throws the covers aside. She's like sleeping in bed and he goes, yeah, I'm here for that. She's like, I'm not gonna beg. Get the scene, and you're like, it's just petty indignity because she's like, in this world, she's smoking hot. Everybody is is looking at her, and like Brock's like, and Brock, who's got the sexual appetite of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, is like, Caesar is like, yeah, not now, I can't. She's like, what the hell, you know? Like,
he explains later that he's still looking for scars on her.
Yeah, you know?
The implants.
yeah, exactly.
Wait, nobody's taking underbite? Are you kidding me?
Dr. Underbite.
Oh my god, that guy's hilarious.
And he gets better and better.
I'll tell you though, like the best like blink and you'll miss it gag I think comes from him, which is like you'll totally miss it, but like he has to take his jaw off in order to peer through the periscope. I thought it was just so freaking hilarious. Like he kind of looks to make sure that nobody's looking around before he looks through the periscope.
Everybody's like,
My favorite blinking you miss it joke is during the Christmas special. When Dean goes, oh no, baby Jesus is out of the manger. And he goes to Brock and it cuts down to his fly real quick.
Yeah. Again. Yes.
He's like, oh good.
That is such a great joke.
It's such a great joke.
Because it's like, using words that have nothing. Brilliant.
And like Dean doesn't get what Brock is doing, but we see it. Like that's,
oh my
and there's
God.
Like, it's like 2 seconds of footage. Yeah. And that's like the comedy quotient that is so rich. So good.
That's perfect.
Oh my God.
Oh my
All right.
God.
Well, before I wrap up, a final thought. At the time of this recording, the Venture Brothers finale movie, Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart, is set to release in just a few weeks' time. And the movie, like everything else from the show, was a long time in the making. When news of the Venture Brothers cancellation broke in 2020, despite the fact that the show had already been renewed for an 8th season back in 2018, it was softened a little by the details that both Adult Swim and HBO Max still wanted to do more with the property. Well, fast forward another 3 years, and we're about to see what they mean, as the Venture Brothers movie teases an epic conclusion to this sprawling meta-narrative, as we discover what's to become of one of the missing main characters, whether or not Dr. Venture will finally get out of the red financially, and the truth behind the appearance of a mysterious woman who might bring the Venture family together or blow it apart for good. Having watched only one season of the show, I know enough to know that that description will probably only cover 0.01% of the movie's total content. And absorbing it all in the first viewing is going to be like trying to eat a bouillon cube. I can't wait to watch it a couple times, but before that, I really can't wait to binge the rest of the series so that when the movie drops, I'm at least somewhat ready for it. In a post-cancellation interview published in 2020, show co-creator Doc Hammer said, quote, "In my deepest dreams, I want to be something like Star Trek, where 2 years later, people go, the fans have spoken, you're coming back." Well, that's exactly what happened, which is ironic for a show where epic disappointment and the inevitability of failure are such prominent themes. Nobody expects this movie to tie everything neatly into a bow, of course. In a setting this sprawling and ongoing, things don't end for everyone all at once. We might get a perfect stopping point to look away, but this world will keep going even if we're not around to witness it. Unless, of course, Team Venture implodes the universe or something, which feels like a distinct possibility. But let's get back to the fan response to the show's cancellation. Barely 2 months after the show was canceled, HBO Max general manager Andy Forsell tweeted, quote, "The Venture Brothers fans are passionate but incredibly civil. I've received tons of emails, all of which are short, very well-written notes oozing with politeness. Class fans. Nothing imminent, but know that we're working on it. Hashtag save the Venture Brothers." In our era of hyperculture, I'm often reminded that fan is short for fanatic. and toxic fandom is something that any geek has witnessed firsthand. One of my favorite lines about Star Wars, for example, is no one hates Star Wars quite as much as a Star Wars fan. So when something like the Venture Brothers gets deep sixed, even though another season had been written for it, it's not a stretch to imagine fans getting very ugly in their outrage over it. And yet, that's not what Venture Brothers fans did. The movie was greenlit in part because of how much the fans asked for it and how cool they were as they did it. That might be the show's biggest legacy. Its massive meta commentary on things like toxic nostalgia seemed to have bred a legion of people who got the point so well that it enabled them to give the show the proper ending it deserves. In an age of toxic fandom, to see what a non-toxic fandom can accomplish, or to even see one exist at all, is pretty encouraging. Go Team Venture indeed. This has been Moments of Truth. On behalf of myself, Tom, Chris, and Chris, thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time. Moments of Truth is hosted by Bill Coffin, Chris Crenshaw, Tom Hespos, and Joe Pace. This podcast is edited by Derek Eisenhart. The Moments of Truth theme is a mashup of The Claremont by Flash Fluherty and A Little Help from a Texas Instruments Speak and Spell. For more Moments of Truth, be sure to subscribe to this show wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or check us out on YouTube or at momentsoftruth.show. And now, a little crass commercialism. Thanks for listening.
3, 2, 1. Dollars.
When Andy Chester loses his young wife Lisa to breast cancer, he finds himself on a grief journey with no certain destination. As he confronts his greatest fears about death, Andy must reckon with the possibility that there may be no life after Lisa. Read After Lisa, the new novel by best-selling author Joe Pace, available now on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
Susie Faulkner has fought against the darkness her whole life, but will her skills be enough against her evil equal? Never Back Down, number 3 in the Faulkner Family Thriller Series by Christopher Swan, available now.
Experience 53 of the greatest weird fiction short stories ever published by Mary Shelley, H.P. Lovecraft, Gray Lespina, Ambrose Bierce, and many more in Tales from the Outer Canon, a new weird fiction anthology edited by Bill Coffin. Get Tales from the Outer Canon today on Amazon or for free on archive.org. The Yellow King.